drawing room over here.
Oh, hey, come on in. Early success in music doesn't always translate to a long career. But after he won the first Australian Idol in 2003, Guy Sebastian hasn't looked back. Platinum albums, music awards, Eurovision, he's even performed for Oprah. And he's my guest in the drawing room. Welcome.
Well, thank you.
I said that the most excitedly. Yeah. That's clearly like...
The Oprah thing was pretty cool, I got to say. I don't get starstruck really ever, but yeah, performing for her. I performed for her twice when she was here in Australia. I did this event on the harbour and then she rang... straight after, and she was like, I need Guy to perform at our private rap party. And so I went and performed for just like the Harpo rap party. And so it was just there. And she was on stage the whole time, arm around us and like dancing and singing along. It was awesome.
So you got one of those Oprah hugs.
I did. Just
they're
just
hard to get. And when you get one,
oh yeah,
you never look back.
I haven't washed for a very long time.
So after you won Australian Idol, did you have any sort of plan on how to keep things going?
No. If you know me, I'm not really a planner.
Not much of a planner.
No, so I think my thing was just, this has happened. Don't screw it up, like just keep going. And so I think that's been how I've operated. And it was driven by, I guess, this notion that I'm so grateful. You know, my entry into this industry was pretty weird. Like I didn't know what Idol was. And Jules, who's outside, she auditioned with me. My wife had been together for a long time. And we didn't even know if it would make it to television. So it was a really strange thing. I mean, I had been here. I came over to Melbourne by train and I saved up all my money and made these demos and I was told you've got a great voice but you don't have the look or you're a bit overweight or you whatever. I just didn't have the image and it was very image focused pop back then. So I sort of resigned to the fact that it wasn't going to happen for me. And so when Idol came along, I was really nervous and didn't know what was going to sort of come from it. And then when people actually got their phones out, they voted, like that's actual money. People saw me on TV. They went, that weird looking bloke, I like him. I'm going to actually spend money so that he can do his thing. And so I think that's been my biggest driving force, is this, that I was made, I guess on a career level, like my platform was made literally just by people investing in me. And I don't want to screw that up.
I think most people would assume that Idol is very image focused as well, but your experience was somewhat different to that, right?
I to be honest, I've found Idol to be the complete opposite. I think it's a great vehicle as far as it really helped strip away all the stereotypes of pop music, you know, and you had someone like Susan Boyle win in the UK or, you know, so many other winners that, you know, Casey Donovan and people that don't necessarily fit that classic pop star mold, myself included. I was a chubby afro head weird sort of looking guy, and so I think what it did was it focused people back on just it being about the voice, and you know, there was some really good looking people, and I was nervous in these auditions because I'm looking around and there's these like beautiful people and great style and could dance and all this sort of stuff, but everything leveled out when they couldn't sing and you know, someone went from being extremely attractive to like, oh, this is a train wreck.
Can't hit a neck.
Yeah, exactly.
So coming to fame from something like Idol, how long did it take to take control of your own career?
Once again, I don't feel like I ever needed to. It was. I feel like I've only really taken control over the last sort of year and a half, if I'm being honest.
Well, good, be honest.
And
why did it take so long then?
Well, I didn't feel out of control. I felt like, you know, it's a really odd thing to step into from complete obscurity to then going, oh, you're now getting paid to do this and there's all these responsibilities and then you put all of your trust in a few people. And it doesn't take a lot for things to come undone and for you to realize that if you don't steer the ship and are a good steward of everything, that things can quickly fall away and in a dramatic fashion. And so I've had a pretty hard sort of year and a half, 2 years. It's been pretty tough. pretty messy, awful manager split, and still ongoing, and trying to deal with the you know, sort of fallout from that, and then also just a realization, I guess, that you're trying to balance not being jaded. And that's why you see so many artists, they just get so jaded. And so they throw the baby out with the bathwater because a few people screw them. And it doesn't happen just on your career. Like, you can go down and buy a car and that dude will screw you, you know, like, because they see you coming. And so you can be real quick to sort of almost put everyone in that same basket. Oh, everyone wants to screw me, or you know, everyone wants to take advantage. But it's just not the case. Like, there's so many beautiful people out there that don't want to do that, and it's just that tough balance of trying to navigate through this industry and have good people around you.
So how have you avoided being jaded so far?
I've got beautiful people around me. I've got my wife. My best mate is just such a legend. Another best mate who I just sung with, you know, Gary Pinto. I was just with him and people like him. And, you know, I've got someone great who's just started working for me outside. And we feel like, I feel like I've got this great team now and this great manager, and everything's transparent and it's open and no one has anything to hide. And it's sort of, so sometimes it just takes a little bit of, going through that desert to sort of fine tune what you need and the people you should have around you. So, yeah.
So you talk about this messy breakup. Was that that relationship? I mean, you don't have to go through all the details, but was it having an effect on the music as well?
I think anything personally has an effect on your music in ways that you don't know about. So, I mean, if you're not in a good place, like, you're just not going to create well, you know, or if you're in a place like, you know, I've got a song now called Before I Go, and the song is literally about not letting someone else's words and someone else decide your fate. And it, so it says things like, you know, I'll say when I'm done, you know, I'm not going to have somebody say that I'm past my use by date or I've got nothing else to give or whatever. It's those sort of things that, if you're hearing that sort of thing, how are you going to sit down in a studio and feel confident to make a song or to get on stage and feel confident when somebody's or people are saying things that aren't necessarily encouraging or even just on a guidance level aren't really having your back? So I think there's a lot of there's a lot to be said that, you know, when you've got people around you professionally, a huge part of their job, I guess, also is to make sure you're in a space where you can create, not just to pay bills or to, you know, to do some admin.
We're going to hear that song, actually, and I think you've already adequately told us what it's about. So let's just hear it on RN. I'm Patricia Carvalis. Guy Sebastian is my guest in the drawing room. We're going to hear his song, Before I Go. You thought you had me. You thought that I was dumb, but I'm stronger up against the was Guy Sebastian with Before I Go, and Guy is my guest in the drawing room. You worked with a couple of other writers on that track. Is that how you prefer to work, to have others to collaborate with?
It's not a preference, but it's an incredibly enjoyable process. I just love people, and I mean I write on my own a lot, but if I can have a choice, I'd rather. It's like working in an office. Some people like being on their own. I would, if I was in an office job, I have to have people around. So, you know, when you get into a studio and you can be creative with people, it's awesome. It makes it not work and it makes it really fun. And, you know, I wrote this song with a guy called Jamie Hartman and Dave Hodges. Now, Dave Hodges, he actually wrote one of my favorite pop songs sung by a female artist called Christina Perry. And it's a song called Thousand Years. And it's just such a beautiful song. And then Jamie Hartman wrote, I'm only human after all, for Rag and Bone Man, this really soulful song. Actually, a lot of people have said, your new song's got a bit of a Rag and Bone Man feel. And I'm like, well, you don't say.
Funny that.
Yeah, exactly.
So you mentioned, you know, feeling good and that kind of your past your use by date kind of approach that some people have, and you don't want them in your orbit. Do you feel like there is a cult of youth that makes being a pop star almost impossible? Like, you know, there is, you know, you've only got these years in your prime and then it's over.
I don't think so anymore. I mean, the biggest song, I released Battle Scars and that was taken over. That was the biggest song in Australian history, right? Which is, that was me. I didn't know that would happen. And then Gautier comes along with Somebody I Used to Know. What a song. Amazing song. Now, he didn't release that when he was 21. You know, I don't think anyone really cares anymore. And I think it leads back to what I was saying before about that cultural shift where a lot of pop stereotypes were shattered. I honestly, it sounds strange, but I do think TV had a bit to do with that. I think shows like Idol, it started to unpick that image, and it just boils down to image. Like, do they look young, you know, or do they fit that certain image? I think people have so much access to music. Like, you look at streaming and radio and everything that provides people with music. People are just after quality now. They're not being fed by a company what a manufactured, you know, pop thing should look and sound like. People are craving things that are a bit different, things that have a soul and a heartbeat to it.
You're part of the ABC's Don't Stop the Music show at the moment. You're working with kids on music.
Yes.
What sort of musical education did you have as a kid?
It was amazing. I went to a great school in Adelaide. You know, it's only a small school, but we had really passionate teachers. And you know, through this documentary, that's what I've learned. It's not necessarily about your facilities. It really boils down to the teachers. And, you know, we've seen Andrew, one of the teachers on the show, and then we see Lee Sameshi, who's the principal. And it's their passion that drives everything, and that care and that love for these kids to make sure they've got equal opportunities, regardless of, you know, socioeconomic status or whatever. They want every kid to have the same access to these things that develop their brains and give them confidence and all the things that come with music education. I had that when I grew up, and that's why it was a bit heartbreaking to learn of some of the statistics that so many schools in this country don't have that. And I think the danger is sometimes we look at numeracy and literacy and we will judge, you know, a school based on that, and you know, we pick subjects based on that as well. Whereas in early development, what I learned through Dr. Anita, who's on this show, is just how crucial things like music are for the neurological development of a child's brain. And, you know, I saw it firsthand with my kid. Jules and I were laughing before because Hudson, he's got a beautiful voice. He's six, and he was singing the other day, and I was singing a harmony. But, you know, when you're young, you can't concentrate on two things. Like, so he kept venturing over to my harmony, and I was like, "Huddy, try and concentrate on your bit and ignore Dad's, and you'll hear how beautiful a harmony sounds." And took him a few goes, and then suddenly he was doing it, but I could see the concentration and like what was happening. And then Dr. Anita was like, "Well, guy, you know, he is concentrating on what he's doing, and he's taking in what you're doing, but then telling his brain to ignore it and to stay on his path." And so there's so much development going on in that moment that, you know, when he sits in a classroom and there's roadworks outside or there's noise and kids outside, he's able to subconsciously get rid of that noise and concentrate on what the teacher's doing. And so I think people really view music education as a career path, you know, like, "Oh, I don't really care if my kid's a muso at the end of that, but I'd rather him be a lawyer or a, you know, whatever." But it's so much more holistic than that. There's such a huge benefit to music education.
Okay, so you're okay with your kids being musicians rather than, I don't know, accountants?
Of course. As long as my kids are healthy and happy, they can do whatever they want.
Okay. They do sing, though, don't they? They love singing.
They love singing.
And they like you singing your songs.
My songs, they do.
So you're like completely indoctrinating them. You're like, "At least I've got them."
Exactly.
Even if one day the country leaves me, I've got them.
I've got my boys. Yeah, Jules was just playing this little, actually I'll play a little snippet off my phone. I just got her to airdrop it to me because we were in the car listening to this. They are big Guy Sebastian fans and they were singing along. This is pretty cute. Hang on. So cute.
Amazing.
That's my four-year-old.
Well, but move over, Guy Sebastian. Seriously. Get the four-year-old on stage.
No, you should see my six-year-old. He is like, he's got a little indie voice.
Yeah.
It's weird. He's like, he'll sing it like this. He'll be like, you know my name, Fargo. Like, he's got this weird, like this super millennial indie voice. I'm like, Jules and I, like, where did he get that from? But he sings with such amazing pitch and feel. Like, he's really good.
I'm loving it. I'm loving it on so many levels. Now, you and your wife, Jules, have your own foundation, yeah? Why did you set it up?
Look, I guess for a long time doing this, you come into contact with a lot of people. And for years, I was just receiving letters about various things that people were going through. And I'd try and help here and there, and always wanted to set up something official that I could use, just an official vessel that I could use it to help people. And so we sort of went through the rigmarole of setting up a charity, which isn't easy. No. There's a lot of for good reason. It's a hard process, but we deal a lot with domestic violence. You know, we really want to help the core of the family, and in a lot of scenarios that is the mother, there's so much domestic violence in this country. It's just alarming. It's an epidemic. And you know, just last month, the first 10 days, there was 8 deaths at the hands of a violent partner. We're such a small country, you know, but 1 in 3 women have experienced violence since the age of 15. One woman loses their life a week at the hands of a violent partner. That's mind-blowing to me. And so there's such alarming statistics out there about, even if you're trying to escape that, you know, the chances of getting into a shelter are so slim because they're all full. And so we've gone into about 7 or 8 shelters, and some of them run on very basic funding, very, very basic funding. So when a hot water system goes, or if the kitchen is below standard and they can't even really cook in it, there's just no extra funding to address those issues. So we've gone in, we've put new kitchens. We partner with Freedom Kitchens, who have been amazing. Like we've done, I think we've done 5 or 6 kitchens with them. So, you know, it's not just about aesthetics. We've also gone in, made them more functional. So, for example, there's one in Manly where they can fit in 2 more women per night.
Right. Yeah.
And just in one, yeah, that's one project we did. Yeah. 2 more a night. We've been really fortunate with some of the, we support some mentoring programs. We support these programs where they help women get back into the workforce after escaping these violent situations, and even to give them legal advice and stuff like that. So it's been a pretty confronting issue to face, but we feel like we're making a difference.
Hey, Guy, thanks for coming in.
Pleasure.
Guy Sebastian has been my guest in the drawing room. His latest single is Before I Go. He's about to go, of course. His new album will be out early next year.